Ja, hallo, hier ist Vizeherrschaft zurück in der Axiom-Sendung. Und zwar geht es jetzt weiter und mit einem Gespräch, das gleich beginnt mit David Kettler. David Kettler ist in dem Sinne Experte zum Karl Mannheim. Er hat zum Beispiel sehr viel über Karl Mannheim gearbeitet, auch in Deutschland studiert. Er wurde 1930 in Leipzig geboren. Er sagt dann in dem Text Negotiations, geschrieben wie Negations, aber in Klammern OT, like Negotiations. Learning from three Frankfurt schools, sagt er, it all starts in Leipzig, where I was born on 1st of July 1930. My father came to Germany from Kärnten in 98 at age 3 and my mother from Brody in 1940 at age 12. Posthumously, they are both from Ukraine, also von der Ukraine. They were Ostjuden, in short, without more than primary education, but they were also acculturated to the world of standing room at the opera. My mother's parents were sheltered by orthodoxy, but her brother were worldly and reasonably successful businessmen. She met my father at the Bar Kochba Sports Club, which she had fought to attend, and she overcame family opposition to marry the slightly younger, impecunious son of a thoroughly secularized and Russified household. Until the Ryan takeover of the stores, my father worked as an ill-paid stock clerk in my uncle's business, but my parents sought to cultivate my brother and me to middle-class German-Jewish standards. Until it was forced shut on November 10th, 1938, my slightly older brother and I attended the Höhere Jüdische Schule, contacted by a husband and wife belonging to the famous rabbinical Kalichbach family. According to my cousin Heinz, midway in age between my father and me and a survivor of 7 years in concentration camps, my father was leftist in his politics and read avidly about the Soviet Union. I cannot say of my own knowledge, since he died on April 1940, 4 weeks after our arrival in the United States, when he had just turned 35 and I was just approved my 10th birthday. For the first 4 years in the United States, my mother worked in a factory and we were dependent on distant relations for occasional outings in middle-class America. Diese Zeit bestimmt David Kettler auch, indem wir auch über die 30er Jahre arbeitet, zum Beispiel darüber, wie es zu diesem bemerkenswerten Aufstieg Karl Mannheims kommen konnte in den 30er Jahren. Denn dazu sagte er, Franz Neumann kommentierte 1953 die oft erstaunlich erfolgreichen Karrieren zahlreicher exilierter deutscher Intellektueller seiner eigenen Generation, indem er sowohl die Bereitschaft von Colleges und Universitäten in den Vereinigten Staaten betonte, das Risiko einzugehen, uns Arbeit anzubieten, wie die Freundlichkeit, mit der wir empfangen wurden, und die nahezu vollständige Abwesenheit jeglichen Ressentiments hervorhob. Man darf ruhig annehmen, dass Faktoren wie diese in Deutschland nahezu vollständig fehlten, um den als Exil selbst stilisierten Berufsweg eines jungen Ungarn, Karl Mannheim, dessen jüdische Herkunft zudem öffentlich bekannt war, zu erleichtern, als er 1921 in Heidelberg ankam. Gegen seine Habilitation wurde innerhalb der Heidelberger Philosophischen Fakultät vehement opponiert. Und sein späterer Ruf an die Universität Frankfurt wurde vom preußischen Ministerium für Wissenschaft, Kunst und Volksbildung gegen den Widerstand der Wirtschafts- und Sozialwissenschaftlichen Fakultät und ihres Dekans durchgesetzt. Doch in einem bestimmten Sinn gilt Neumanns Beobachtung auch für Deutschland in der Weimarer Zeit. Für einen kurzen historischen Augenblick öffnete sich an mehreren Universitäten eine Art Lücke für eine relativ kleine Gruppe von Personen und nicht wenige von ihnen konstituierten später den Kern des von Neumann angesprochenen intellektuellen Exils. Der Fokus dieses Papiers über die bemerkenswerte Erfolgsgeschichte Karl Mannheims besteht darin, nachzuvollziehen, oder also die ihm in der Weimarer Republik gebotene Chance zu beleuchten. Kettlers These ist hier, dass zwei charakteristische soziologische Themen Mannheims eine Erklärung genau dieser Chance ermöglichen. Seine soziologischen Betrachtungen der Generation und der Intelligenz. Er erfuhr seinen Aufstieg eben als Angehöriger der jungen Nachkriegsgeneration sowie als Mitglied einer kulturellen intellektuellen Schicht, darunter einige Immigranten und viele Juden, aber alle Außenseiter der in den etablierten wissenschaftlichen Disziplinen dominierenden Traditionen. Die partielle und nur vorübergehende Öffnung mehrerer deutscher Universitäten für außergewöhnlich talentierte Wissenschaftler, die beide Attribute besaßen, war eine Funktion der besonderen politischen Verhältnisse der Weimarer Republik, genau wie das amerikanische Pendant, von Neumann etwas übertrieben gepriesen, durch die Franklin-Roosevelt-Area geprägt war. In beiden Fällen sollten die verheißungsvollen Resultate oft als Leistung oppositioneller Minderheiten innerhalb dieser Institutionen angesehen werden. Es gelang ihnen, herrschende Interessen angesichts der allgemeinen institutionellen Verwirrung ihrer Zeit zu neutralisieren oder zu überwinden. Die New Deal-Mobilmachung gegen die Wirtschaftskrise ist das amerikanische Beispiel und die verschiedensten lokalen und oft unsicheren Solidaritätsgesten mit der neuen Demokratischen Republik sind das deutsche Beispiel. Aber nur unversöhnte Feinde der Neueinkommlinge konnten ernsthaft die reduktionistische Auffassung vertreten, dass ihre Berufung rein politischer Natur seien. Die Talente der wenigen, die hier und da die sich bietenden Gelegenheiten ergreifen konnten, waren absolut real und die auf diese Weise möglich gewordenen Karrieren führten zu oft bedeutenden intellektuellen Leistungen und kulturellen Schöpfungen. Die amerikanischen und deutschen Beispiele sind mehr als bloße Parallelfälle. Sie sind historisch eng verkettet. Die Selbstkonstituierung der intellektuellen Generation Mannheims während der späten Weimarer Jahre als relative unabhängige Kraft, eine Selbstkonstituierung, die unterstützt wurde von der Legitimität, die repräsentative Persönlichkeiten durch ihre Universitätsberufungen erlangten, muss aus uns die Behauptung Neumanns anzweifeln lassen, dass die gastfreundliche Gesinnung der amerikanischen Hochschulen ein tragisches Problem zu einer glücklichen Lösung brachten. Zumindest gilt für Mannheim, dass der Verlust der vielversprechenden Erwartungen der Weimarer Generation im Exil wie niemals wieder gut gemacht wurde. Mannheims eigener Erfolg in seinem zweiten Exil in England ist also nicht mit einem Happy End identisch. Und um dann eben zu verstehen, was Mannheim unter Generation versteht, hat David Kettler dann auch ein Beispiel, das ich jetzt hier auch noch vorlesen möchte, bevor ich dann gleich das Interview mit ihm spiele. Und zwar Mannheim als Universitätsintellektueller. In einer ungarischen Exilzeitschrift warnt Mannheim seine Leser im Jahr seiner Ankunft in Heidelberg. Darüber hatten wir ja schon gesprochen, dass Mannheim von Budapest 1919 nach Heidelberg flüchten musste nach der Revolution dort. Dass sein Verständnis der deutschen Kultur durch seine geistige Verwandtschaft mit einer kleinen dünnen Schicht der heutigen deutschen progressiven Intellektuellen bestimmt sei. Mich interessiert heute, schreibt er, in erster Linie das Leben derer, zu denen ich gehöre. Wir, die wir Bücher schreiben und lesen und die beim Schreiben und Lesen einseitig nur der Geist interessiert. Bildung ist der Schlüsselbegriff. Durch Bildung und durch genuinen Humanismus formiert sich eine neuartige Schicht von Menschen, die ökonomische und andere soziologische Klassifikationen durchquert. Bildung gestaltet auch die spontansten Lebensformen und transportiert den Menschen in eine isolierte Welt, die anderen unzugänglich ist. Als im Exil Lebender und als Fremder, der seinesgleichen anspricht, kommt Mannheim zu dem Schluss, er sei immer wieder erstaunt, um wie viel näher ich denen stehe, die an dieser Humanität beteiligt sind und wie viel näher sie mir stehen als ich oder sie der zu ihrer Nationalität gehörenden, aber ganz anderen Menschensorte. Mannheims reflektierendes Nachdenken über diese Schicht, also diese intellektuellen Schicht, bleibt dann vielleicht konstantestes lebenslanges Interesse. Selbst als er sich in seinen letzten Jahren in England eher anderen Problemen zuwandte, sammelte er doch weiter Materialien, wie das Mannheim-Archiv in Kehle beweist, für eine abschließende historische Arbeit zu diesem Thema. Der Begriff des Intellektuellen ist umstritten. Im offiziellen mitteleuropäischen Sprachgebrauch ist auch Intellektueller mehr oder weniger identisch identisch mit durch Universitätsbildung erreichtem oder befestigtem politischen Ansehen und sozialen Status. Mannheim betont in seinem eigenen intellektuellen Begriff dagegen die besondere Bedeutung einer aktiven Untergruppe. Die Zentralität des Intellektuellen in Mannheims berühmtesten Buch Ideologie und Utopie ist bekannt. Aber schon seine Wendung zu Alfred Weber und dessen Kultursoziologie 6 Jahre zuvor war durch reges Interesse an diesem modernen, wesentlich urbanen sozialen Segment gekennzeichnet, das Individuen verschiedener Klassen vereinte, die durch ein gemeinsames Engagement für die Aneignung, Produktion und Reproduktion von Bildung verbunden waren, das soziale Pendant zum Aufstieg der Kultur als autonomer Sphäre in der nachaufklärerischen Epoche. Dieser soziale Standort ist die Quelle liberaler, konservativer und anderer Ideologien, behauptet Mannheim, aber er macht auch die Kultursoziologie überhaupt erst möglich. Die rätselhafte Verbindung dieser beiden Aspekte der Bildungskultur wurde zum Hauptthema von Mannheims Habilitation über das konservative Denken und verwandter Studien. Die freischwebenden Intellektuellen, wie sie als Begriff nicht erst in Ideologie und Utopie entwickelt wurden, wo der Sozialtypus des Intellektuellen dann primär auf sein Potenzial hin untersucht wird, mit wissenssoziologischen Methoden eine Politik als Wissenschaft zu erreichen, ist sozusagen dieser freischwebende Intellektuelle, schreibt Mannheim, das sind dann die typischen Rechtfertigungsdenker, Ideologen, die jedes politische Wollen, dessen Dienst sie sich stellen, zu unter- und zu Hintergründen verstehen. Eine solche Mentalität ist nur ein Aspekt mehrerer nachfolgender Untersuchungen Mannheims über die beunruhigende Wahlverwandtschaft zwischen bestimmten Gruppen von Intellektuellen und dem Faschismus, der am wenigsten Intellektuellen aller Ideologien. Der Faschismus entsteht auch dort, wo Intellektuelle ohne Bezug auf die historisch gewachsenen sozialen Akteure der Zivilgesellschaft Macht erlangen wollen. Um zudem in Ideologie und Utopie beschriebenen konstruktiven Intellektuellen als wichtigsten Mitarbeiter an der notwendigen Synthese zu werden, durch die ideologisches Misstrauen in einen öffentlichen Prozess realistischer politischer Verhandlungen transformiert werden kann, müssen Intellektuelle erst einmal sich selbst entdecken, indem sie die Geisteshaltung kritisch explorieren, die immer expliziter im neuen Universitätsfach Soziologie artikuliert wird. Die Universität und insbesondere die Soziologie müssen sich umgekehrt der experimentellen Haltung der Intellektuellen öffnen, ihrer kritischen Distanz zum orthodoxen, philosophischen und pädagogischen System. Und David Kettler, der am Bard College in New York immer noch präsent ist und unterrichtet und dort auch auf seiner Webseite Bard College David Kettler kann man auch einige seiner Texte dann sich anschauen und auch downloaden. Mit ihm habe ich im Mai ein sehr informelles Gespräch geführt, im Grunde über seine Arbeit und auch über Mannheim und diese ideologische Position der Intellektuellen, die jetzt zum Beispiel über Revolution reden, aber das Gespräch geht auch über Afghanistan und über verschiedene Aspekte des politischen Denkens dieser Zeit. Kettler hat zum Beispiel auch einen Text geschrieben, den wir vorher diskutiert hatten, der Time Wars heißt. Where is it? Okay, later this. Und da steigen wir jetzt ein. Bis gleich.
So even when he's teaching the class, remember that what the students can do, he can't do, because he doesn't have their experiences to explicate. So that, you know, so he says, and this is sometimes in the literature simply said to be Elias's idea, but I think it's very deeply structured in Mannheim's own thinking, so I don't want to know the secrets of that bedroom either, you know, what Mannheim knew and what Elias knew. But when he says, okay, you work from your experience as a woman and reflect on it, and then from that you can reconstruct whole world. It's almost a kind of a Leibnizian monad idea, but it is really that each person has their own grounding on the basis of which the communication, the intercommunication of that knowledge, or its creation of ein Wissen, your excellent question, is left quite problematic. It's not to be systematized. Because remember the systematization and so on, this is this is an artifact of the Lernbetrieb. You know, he's very belittles that.
Yeah.
And so the question of sociology as a and that's when then this word of experimentalism comes in. So that you have these multiple experiments, and they are congruent only in the sense that they're, and I'm embarrassed to use this Heideggerian, that they're authentic, you know, that they're echt, that they're grounded in a reflection and in this insight. So I think that this is, so this, I mean, you know, that was my first, to me, it was, I was then puzzled by all the attempts to systematize Mannheim. When in Ideologie and Utopie, he says in the introduction, these are a series of experiments, and they're not consistent with each other, although that first essay, Ideologie und Utopie, which is the weakest, is an attempt to somehow bring them together. That doesn't work, because really the concept, I mean, they're almost mutually exclusive. That when he takes the Utopie concept and puts all energy and all development into that utopian moment, which is by no means prepared for by the ideology concept as it operates in Politik als Wissenschaft, where it's an equally comprehensive. So these are really fundamentally competing or contrasting or at best complementary efforts. And I think that now you can either say, okay, this means that this is really Schöngeisterei, and that in the end you need to find some philosophically more authentic, more radical way in, which is then why certainly Horkheimer and Adorno both wrote these Harsh and Marcuse and Arendt. I mean, I just in my website you can connect. It's a kind of an interesting exercise. You know, Bard has the Arendt library, the remains of Arendt's library, because her husband had been a teacher at Bard, and they are both, their ashes are buried in the little cemetery that we have. And so her books are at Bard. Yeah. Or at least, that's an ungainly.
And she read Mannheim, I think. Is it met?
Yes. This is the preparation. So what I've done, what I did as a contribution to the website that they have in the library website, I found her annotated text of Ideologie und Utopie, and also the essay on competition. And they're not very extensive annotations, but there are annotations. And so I put for the website, I didn't publish it, but for the website, I have an annotated, I have two things. I have a transcription of all of her annotations and underlinings, so that you can actually see, and I actually sat there and did it. I spent 2 months last summer on this, of copying out the passages she underlined and showing, and also marking me. And then
she underlined by Mannheim, yeah?
No, that she in Mannheim, yes. Oh, that, right. she to see what she was looking for when she was reading him. And then I took the review she wrote of Mannheim's Ideologie und Utopie, and I cross-referenced them. so that and I wrote a commentary then on her. I wrote a marginal commentary, a little more commentary, 30, 40 items, on explaining her annotation, her underlinings, by reference to the review that she then wrote. So the package, so the website has, and you know, look at has. But what's interesting about it, and this is why I bring it in, is that like. Certainly, Horkheimer and Adorno. Marcuse, he was quite interesting because Marcuse is much more open to Mannheim. At least he grants him that he opens questions that are the essential questions. He's dissatisfied with the conclusions, but he, and this has to do with, I think probably, and I have not studied this side of Marcuse. Has to do with the Heideggerian common reference, so that he welcomes the question of the cognitive content of ideologies in some way. He's open to that, whereas both Horkheimer and Adorno are scornful of the scornful is the word probably. There's a lot of anger. But somehow it has to do with the betrayal of Marxism, because there's always a layer here, certainly in Horkheimer and at that time in Adorno as well. I mean, it was always more aesthetic version, but still of a deep intuition about the core Marxist revolutionary possibility. I mean, that was something.
This is still existing here in the discourses on Marx, and it's now coming back with this book from Hart and Hegri about multitude and. Do you know Michael Hart?
I don't know him, no.
And they really kept this idea of multitude to explain a new form of global movement as a new revolutionary subject.
This is such utter rubbish. It's far immoral rubbish. I mean, it is, you know.
It's really existing, and the Spannungsfeld ist immer noch das Gleiche, ist mein Eindruck in der Philosophie der Revolution und dann der Philosophie des Verstehens.
Ja, da ist doch schließlich eine, ich muss sagen, das ist auch eine geniale, ein genialer Einfall. Man kann verstehen, wieso die Leute sich. If you don't want to have a Christian conversion experience, you know, it has this wonderful plausibility, and yet it's the most. But it also means, I mean, here's the less. I mean, it is unquestionable, and it hit me yesterday. You know, when I was pressed to speak to the philosophical issue, I've forgotten his name, you know, the one of the assistants in the discussion. Or maybe it was the Frenchman.
Abelin.
Who was then quite impatient because I wouldn't address, because I wouldn't go to some kind of philosophical core. And the point is that there isn't one. There isn't one in that sense. That is, there is no systematizing core unless one is prepared to accept the pluralism as a system.
Or the relativity.
Yes.
Of these structures.
Yeah, but it's a relativity that is congruent still at least with the idea of what he, as he formulated later, that you can do a diagnose, that you can do a sort of a Gegenwarts, but that you can find a common, that the process of Wissenssoziologie or informed discussion can create parameters, can lay out parameters which are in some way adequate to the times. So, but it isn't an integral theoretical structure. That is to say that it doesn't it couldn't be deduced from any philosophical grounding. And it's in that sense that I think he's quite sincere when he always says that he's really an empiricist.
Yeah.
So this discussion in this little paper with, what's his name, with in the paper that we circulate, that was circulated for the seminar of Deutsch, there's the Klingemann. Is it Klingemann or wie heißt er? The man who objected in this paper that was circulated in German. There is.
It is a Geheimnis des bemerkenswerten Aufstiegs in diesem Aufstieg.
Yeah, there is one of the props is the critique of Carsten Klingemann, who denies that Mannheim can be understood in any sense as an empiricist.
And diesen Anspruch, die Generation zu repräsentieren.
Yeah, and it had with this imperialism to do.
Yeah.
And so I think that the question of that the way to approach Mannheim and to make use of all, to learn from it. In other words, to ask to study Mannheim in order to get to learn a lot about some fundamental philosophical questions. Except it is not as productive as reading him more imminently as sociologist or as intellectual who finds then the sociological discourse some appropriate mode of inquiry and extrapolation, but there is a notion of a sort of the autonomy of these Einstellungen, and you know it comes in the form of metaphor, wo ein Begriff zu Hause ist, oder wo eigentlich hingehört, and this is then this whole idea of a structure of these structures, and this is not philosophically worked out. Although he has some, you know, the person who knows the philosophical background best and has freshly in this regard is Laube. Have you seen his big fat book on the historismus? That's new.
This came out after my thesis, so that's why I have to have a look at
Yeah, no, I think you should. He's really, it's quite, he's almost pedantic, he's a historian, it's a problem history, and so it is quite somewhat longer than it needs to be, but he, in the first place, he does have the background to, he can read the Hungarian and Hungarian. He learned. He's married to a Hungarian woman who is herself does quite interesting things, and he was in Budapest, and he can read the Hungarian that went into it, and also you know he's quite well versed in sort of the philosophical tradition in some way. Has paid because I cut into the whole problematic at a different level, so that I never went back and did all that work. In fact, at the conference we had in Erlangen, where the 1930, which is where I met Laube, where I gave him my copy of a book and said, "Okay, it's yours now," you know, because I was very impressed by his. So anyway, it's. I may have exaggerated, but you should take a look at it.
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't know that he and I are in full agreement, but he's then a good reference point, precisely because he knows the historismus Streit. So thoroughly. So in any case, I think that one can. I don't want to go into. To make exaggerated claims, either for the readings that I've been involved in over the years of Mannheim, but I think that where the issue of the cognitive content and your excellent question, became very pertinent to me again. There is a man has a very interesting, I don't know if you've come across it, a project, is now a little mini institute at Oxford on political ideology. Mm. Do you know it has a journal called Political Ideology?
Yeah, that's very interesting because this is a kind of underlying theme to understand what are the current political ideologies which are still influenced by.
Right, and it's a good and interesting kind of a, he has a kind of a morphological view of the structures of ideologies, and he's a moment. I'm afraid I'm blocking his name. It's not Fried. He's an Israeli, actually.
Yeah.
Very pleasant, very good man.
Yeah.
And I was at the opening conference they had on sort of for their project, and it became clear as I, and there were people then working from all sorts of post-structuralist strategies, and kind of an assemblage of people who from a lot of contemporary perspectives were working on the in some way on the problem of ideology. So, I mean, it's a discussion that this man whose name I will come up with, if not right this moment, then I just go upstairs and do it on my computer. So.
Yeah.
But he has a number of books. Also, there's a very small book called Ideology, or Political Ideology, just a small, and he sort of tries to state his differences with various postmodern, post-structuralist approaches, but he also does a critique of philosophy, so of political philosophy. So he denies the distinction between political theory and ideology, but not from a but at the same time, and this is then why I've suddenly recalled it in the context of our discussion. I don't think there is. I mean, there's a certain, I mean, the English, kind of an English relaxed attitude towards the question, towards the reflexivity issue, so that you really, you don't have to have a philosophical underpinning to why this mode of you know, apprehending or of characterizing the world counts as knowledge, that there really isn't some other thing that's more deep or that with reference to which. So he, so this is his basic position, but at the same time, the idea of a, what, say, Mannheim's structural contrast between styles of thought, exactly the things that Barbosa is now pulling out, those things are missing here. So there isn't a sense of that kind of a difference in the mode of knowing, in the style of knowing, not just the style of discourse, but the style of knowing that is present, say, in taking great history, you know, in the conservatismus book. A contrast between liberalism and conservatism, which is then they're both modes of knowing. At the same time, the styles of knowing are fundamentally different. We see time differently, all these variables. And that kind of issue is not addressed because his I want to say Fried, but it's not. His, Mr. X's, Professor Oxford's conception is more a morphology of substantive propositions. Mm-hmm. So you have core, and you have peripheral, and you develop a morphology of what liberalism is, or what conservatism is, or what social democratic thinking and others that he analyzes in terms of a kind of a one-dimensional but very interesting and quite potent sort of field, and then how that interplays with historical change. So it's worth reading. It's a if only as a foil, you know, or if only as a contrast, because what it doesn't do is to deal with your question, your new question about, you know, what constitutes a space.
Mm.
So this, you know, how, you know, how are different, so this third dimension that I hear, I don't know if I've understood you correctly, but it seems to me that you're looking at, you know, even just to use the language of the paper I was discussing the other day, sort of these time-space constructs.
Yeah.
And so your question could be before, is that right?
It's one question, this constitution of space, but I think what I can describe through artists and how they constitute space, because in the art world it is called experimental space as well, so they are...
Yes.
How the art world is now organized, it's really related to what Mannheim would call a kind of experimental space as well.
But it's also a time space. The idea that the Uhren in den verschiedenen Letztandersgehen is, I think, an important part of it. As I was thinking about your very brief conversation, I was thinking about so my initial commonplace was, oh well, but they live in a different time space, they live in a different time, you know, that they have different clocks. And but what you're saying is no, that within even looking at Afghanistan, we can see, now I'm translating, that we can see different time-space pockets in which the authors are differently engaged. I mean, you have to figure out so that certainly the chieftain in some village, either accommodating with Taliban and creating a cultural world or maintaining a cultural world, which, among other things, probably has some location for symbolizations of a kind one might call art when they happen in another sphere.
Mm.
I mean, that's one form of constitution and the actual creation, which is different from, but not undiscussable in relationship to the artist's time-space that are competitively being created, let's say, in Kabul.
Mm.
Maybe that's taking it too far. But you see, this may be because I'm a political scientist and you are not, so that I always want to say, okay, you know, where is this domain within, whether we're talking about Kabul or we're talking about Hong Kong or we're talking about Beijing or Shanghai, more appropriate, which is where the art world is centered in China.
Yeah.
I mean, how is that activity conditioned by, related to, competitive with these other potent time capsules or space capsules that are also present on the scene.
Yeah,
is that too much?
I think a bit stronger could be this idea of relativity, that the social is structured by relativity, and how. And maybe that would be the question: how is a social relativity related to that time space or time capsule? Because what I can describe is the art world through a kind of constitution of social relativity in a very strong sense, like in the natural science sense of relativity, or different perspectives on the world, through perspectivity or how a word is organized.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And yeah, for that I would say I'm looking for a question about this social relativity. And the artists are a very good example for to describe it or to make it easier to understand what it is.
My own hunch is that the image, yes, I mean, I agree with that, I think. And the point about it is, and this is then, you know, I mean, it's danger of stereotype, but you know, that it's almost what Malai meant by relationism. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it has any content, it is something like
yeah.
that, in the sense that within, I mean, you know, his objection to calling it relativism was
yeah.
always that it that
and
relativism.
Relativitate. It's called as well relativitate.
But the point about he always refused to say that because relativitate presupposes the contrast model of non-relative knowledge.
Mm.
And his claim was always that in this domain there is no such contrast model.
Yeah.
So that it is, so there it isn't. And so that to him the constitution of the concept relativism or the relativity is conditional on the contrast model. In that sense, dialectical, if you like, but you don't need Hegel at all. It's the way in which a term is defined by reference to some opposite. And so if you deny, say, no, this is the only knowledge we have, that everyone has to live in some space-time, let's play our game, bubble or house or space, an enclosed space, and that the question is then one of the relationship among those.
Yeah, I mean, but the spaces really separated.
Well, are they? Is that your question?
Yeah.
No, I think that, you know, I think that, for example, I mean, do a little thought experiment.
Mm-hmm.
We take an artist, and I mean, I'm going to make this easy. I have had a friend called E.V. Walter, who wrote a book called Place Waves, and he had something that he called topistics, and the idea of the qualitative, and he was a little bit touched by sort of magical spaces as well, because that was another interest of his, in Kabbalah and solche Sachen. But you know, we can abstract from that, and in the Place Ways book, so you have this idea of you know, these qualitatively different spaces, and one, and so he would, so the reason I thought of him just now is I'm going to take a risk and say, okay, so if, let's for the sake of argument say that you have a part of first place, let's premise that there is such a place. There is such a place as, let's say, Afghanistan, because you know something about it and I don't, or except when I read the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say there is such, and that for some purposes, including the perception internationally and the whole, that there is such a place. There is a, in
mm-hmm.
some sense, there
yeah.
is a bounded area called Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And then within that bounded area, let's say that you have, let's just for the sake of argument, begin as you want to begin, and I like the idea of beginning from something that's concrete and articulated, and to expound that.
Mm.
And so let's talk about your creative space model,
mm.
or relative space, or whatever.
Yeah.
So so let's call this, and we're talking about artists
yeah.
and internal conflicts about exactly what does this mean, and how much reflexivity
yeah.
and how much is, and it's not only artists, the artists and the public, as you say, so,
yeah.
but the attempt to create a kind of a domain so that when you go inside the gallery, just as we know that we then have to put on different glasses, and we're in an experience, and here are all these people problematizing the concept of art, with which we, nevertheless, certainly my generation, you come in with an expectation about art. There's still an ideology about art, and then you're challenged by this, and so you live. So that's what happens in this space.
Yeah.
Okay. So now imagine we look on the landscape, we you know, are flying over it, and now we have something that's in the shape of a yurt, or you know, we have another a kind of space or a village for whom the paradigmatic shape is this enclosure. Is this enclosure with the women's segment of here, with the children there, and the easy access to weapons? And I'm just making a stereotype here, and a notion of community, of the boundaries, conditioned by that core picture. Now imagine a conversation between people in these two places under some, and not only a conversation, but you know, if they meet in this place called Afghanistan in the budget process. Budget the this get the nennt man das nee das ist so die Regierung das der die wo das Geld verteilt wird the household
yeah
okay so they have and so they have to actually meet here right because they're both he needs money.
Yeah.
Wants money for protection, or for he has claim on it for this community, and these people need money here too. And so irgendwie they have to talk to each other,
yeah.
or talk, compete with each other, find some common. And that to call, that's so that rather than saying, well, we start here and then we understand relativism. I think we should start here, and that first sets the problem of relativism, because they're not just having different opinions or different world views. They live in different places.
Yeah, and they have different forms of claiming.
And they're different. Exactly.
Social.
Exactly.
Responsibilities.
And here, and then you can add to the picture, right? Because you see, then there's someone here who's an entrepreneur who thinks that the art industry would be helpful either in creating, we talked yesterday sort of an impression of high culture that would help with investments, or indeed someone more narrow sense who wants to make money from the art business. And so they come and serve as mediators as well as here, where you have parties, political parties, and electorally grounded individuals who come from these communities and who are sensitive either to the interest or to the threat.
Yeah, Afghanistan parties are not existing. There are no political parties.
Well, there are parties in the sense that there were parties before there were parties, let's say, if you think of the English history. So you had coalitions of leading figures, then they had some kind of so that you could speak of government in opposition before there were parties. In to take that simple analogy, German history. Weber talks about the shift from the Honoration, the Politik der Honoration, to.
Yeah. Nach dem Gespräch mit David Kettler über Karl Mannheim, aber auch ein sehr freischwebendes Denken, das sich jetzt zeigte in dem Interview. Jetzt am Schluss Susan Phillips Arbeit The Lost Reflection, das verlorene Spiegelbild. Ja, Mikrofon verabschiedet sich Felicia Herrschaft. Informationen auch zu David Kettler dann auf der Webseite fehe.org unter Aktion. Bis dann.